WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Well, welcome to another Monday Night Talk. My name is Kevin Tachi. We've got a great show lined up for you. I'm going to kind of quickly give you...
Great show.
Great show. That, of course, is State Representative Josh Cutler. He is the first up. He is leading. He's the leadoff hitter. Leading off the program. But just quickly, we got the Weymouth Mayor, Bob Hedlund. We'll be chatting with the mayor about a couple of different things. Union Point and the proposal for Amazon.
Amazon, that's pretty exciting.
That's very exciting. We'll talk a little bit about the Route 18 widening project. Maybe even the Four River Bridge. And you know Mayor Hedlund, sometimes we go off in new other directions, so count on that as well. Bob has not changed, but the conversation will be good. WATD sports reporter Brendan Conley will be in studio. We'll talk a little Boston Red Sox. As we know, the Sox are... They were one game better, and because of it, they fired their manager, and they are searching for a manager. We're going to talk a little Boston Red Sox with Brendan Conley, and maybe I'll try to tease a little of the... fall and winter sports. We'll talk some Bruins.
How about some Celtics?
And some Celtics.
Opening tomorrow night.
Talk some Celtics against who?
Cleveland Cavaliers.
Cleveland Cavaliers. See what happens with that. Mm-hmm. So after we speak with Brendan, we are going to speak with a gentleman who's got 30 years experience when it comes to public speaking. He has now put together a book. The book on public speaking. We'll speak with Topher Morrison.
I'm glad I don't have to follow him. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, but you get good grades. You're a good orator.
Okay. Well.
You do a nice job.
Thank you.
But we start things off with the representative representing the 6th Plymouth District, which is Duxbury, Pembroke, and the town of Hanson, which he just
came from.
Came from as he was there doing a joint venture with State Senator Mike Brady. You were at the Hanson Multi. What's it called?
It's they officially call it the
Multi-Service
Center.
Yes. Center.
Yes.
But you were more
You've
so
been
in
to the lovely Hanson Senior Center. It shares a footprint with the Hanson Library, so they call
correct.
It the Multi-Service Center.
Yes, so you were there. You had a luncheon. How was it?
Yes. So we had a great luncheon. Senator Mike Brady and I co-hosted a senior luncheon, as we like to do every once in a while. And we had a great time. I have a number of folks from not just Hanson, but all of our surrounding areas, much of the ATD listening catchment, and we had a good discussion, had some nice lunch and good questions and conversation, and I think that's one of the important parts of serving in my role is, you know, being a good listener and keeping the lines of communication open and doing it in a fun way. So that was a good
time. What was the biggest concern that you heard from the folks in Hanson?
Oh, well, gosh, you know, it was really all over the map. One lady who was concerned about had a very specific question about Medicare and reimbursement and how that would impact her. Had concerns just about, you know, the cost of living and property taxes. Obviously, that's always on folks' mind. So it's a pretty wide-ranging kind of conversation. And we talked about marijuana. We talked about everything. You name it. Just like your show. Just like Monday Night Talk.
Look, Monday Night Talk is more of a magazine format. At least we have gone away from the design, the format that Senator Hedlund at the time had.
Yes.
His was kind of a free-flowing conversation. Had a lot of great guests in its day. And of course, we all know that Bob has an impeccable memory for a lot of things. With not only the rock concerts that he has gone to throughout the years, but when it comes to legislation. I think he's,
I know when it comes to music, he is an expert. I will definitely defer to him on that. And he and I have had some gentle disagreements about the state rock song issue,
yeah.
which I've come around on, by the way.
Have you really?
I have.
Was that ever decided?
Not been decided.
You mean it's still in the air? Is it still in committee?
It is still in committee, I believe. I didn't. That's one fact I didn't check before coming on, Kevin.
I think the state bird had an easier go of
but
it.
But the official state rock song bill is still in committee, a Roadrunner. So I see, this is a good example. We're joking around here, but it is a good example of finding compromise and consensus.
Common ground.
Yes.
Yeah, but now isn't it? I thought it was your colleague, Representative Cantwell, was the one who was pushing for Aerosmith.
Well, so we were. Yes, move on. Dream on. Move on is sometimes what I like to...
Let's move on to the next subject.
Dream on. But yes, Roadrunner is a fine song, and we're happy to support that. And obviously, we have a lot of important things to going on, but if we do have the opportunity to do that, I certainly would be happy to have that become our state rock song.
See, I'm surprised the governor hasn't weighed in.
He's kind of a music guy, too, yeah.
Another music... Well, yep. Listen to the intro. I mean,
that's right.
We're playing a little Aerosmith, and he was... You know, loving the music coming in.
Nice.
Of course, we're anticipating another opportunity to have the governor on in the near future.
I love this time of year. Rustling leaves, a crisp wind blowing, apple picking for homemade apple pie, a sunny day in a corn maze, a bonfire on a cool night. Cigars, and a half gallon of hot apple cider. Apple pie. We made it ourselves. This has nothing to do with Brennan's Smoke Shop, but everything to do with life. It's short, yet so sweet. Kind of like pumpkin spice coffee. It comes and goes like autumn wind. Brennan's Smoke Shop. Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, and now on Pope's Island in New Bedford. Brennan's Smoke Shop, the very best smoke shop in Massachusetts. Customers must have a valid state or federal ID to enter the store. Message me on Facebook.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk, WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We continue our discussion with State Representative Josh Cutler, as he was here a little early, so we thought we would begin the conversation with him, kind of tease an event that he was in district, and we'll continue on with some of the topics. We get a bunch of different topics to discuss while we have the representative here. First one up on the docket, I know that it's been tough the past couple of budgets, and this past budget, we're actually in the midst of it, the fiscal year 2018's budget. Word is that there's been some vetoes, some overrides for the FY 2018 budget, and your district is, you've been able to get some money for a couple of areas in your district. You want to give us a rundown?
Yeah, Kevin. So, you know, probably the most important thing we do as legislators is pass a budget every year. And, you know, unlike sometimes in Washington, D.C., our budget has to be balanced, and so it has to be in balance. And so that's always, a, you know, obviously a struggle. There's lots of desires and lots of needs, and but we have a limited revenues, and so we have to make do with what we have. So that's always a big part of my role, and any role of any legislator, is to try to advocate for our district, make sure the things that we think are priorities are getting funded as much as we can. And so, you know, that's what we've done. And this year, we're in fiscal, even though we're in 2017, we're in the FY18 budget already.
That's on July 1st.
July 1st runs to the end of June of 2018. Mm-hmm. And so our budget cycle, we've passed our budget for the year for FY18. And the last sort of step in that process is to take up override. So sometimes the governor will veto some of the items that we pass, and that happens both Democratic. I've served with a Democratic governor and a Republican governor, and it's really the same. It's not really so much of a partisan thing as it is just an executive branch versus legislative branch kind of disagreement. And but so a number of things that we passed that I was able to get into the budget, along with the help of my colleagues in the Senate and my colleagues obviously in the House as well, which were vetoed, have now been overridden. So we're able to restore funding through things that we got in the budget the first time that were then cut.
Now, this was House and Senate, or is Senate still pending?
So the House has overridden all the vetoes, so that part is done.
Okay.
The Senate still has some more vetoes to take up. And I understand that they're going to be doing that over the next couple of weeks. But you're
confident, though, that they're going to push this through?
I am confident. I think once the House does that the Senate usually follows through. So okay. To my Senate friends listening out there, I'm staking my reputation on this, so don't let me down.
Okay.
But some of the things, I'll just mention a couple. I don't want to run off a laundry list, but so some funding for the Duxbury Senior Center to make improvements there is at $50,000. Funding for the Pembroke Public Schools for technology upgrades. Our ponds are a key resource here in the South Shore. That's every year an effort we put forward trying to make sure we have funds to treat and take care of our ponds. So we have some funding in there.
Your Wampatucket pond testing.
For testing some of the ponds. Also, along with Rep. Coulter, Rep. Cantwell, and some of our other colleagues, there's funding in there for something called the Central Plymouth County Water District, which is a long, complicated name, but an important commission that takes care of some of the ponds in Central Plymouth County, which have to do with our drinking water supply. And so that's a big concern. So we have funding in there to help them provide more resources. This year I was able to get some funding in for the South Shore Food Pantry based in Pembroke, which does great stuff helping folks in need in Pembroke, but also all around the South Shore. So those are just a few. And again, these are things that I put in, but it's all, politics is a team sport, and it really is our whole South Shore crew working together, Democrats and Republicans. When it comes to this, we're all united. And so, I think my colleagues throughout the South Shore deserve kudos as well for helping to get some of those things through. So good news on the local stuff. And I think good news to segue, Kevin, on a broader budget picture. I know when in some of our previous conversations earlier in the year, there was a lot of concerns about revenues coming in below benchmarks.
Right.
Predicting the state budget revenue is a little more complicated than predicting revenues for a single town, which is based, traditionally on property taxes, which are pretty stable, whereas a state budget's based on a variety of incomes, a variety of different sources of revenue, from the income tax, sales tax, capital gains tax, which are much more variable. And so changes, even changes at the federal level in Washington, D.C., can have a significant impact, and we feel them here in Massachusetts in terms of our revenue. So making predictions ahead of time, sometimes a year ahead of time or more, it's art and science. And so we have to, and again, because we have to live within our means and stick within our budget, it does cause some heartburn occasionally when we have revenues that come in lower than we expect. And that happens somewhat in the spring. The good news is that so far this fiscal year, as we start in July, we're off to a good start. And in fact, through September, our revenue figures are up above our predictions by a couple percentage points, $135 million. So that's some good news. Obviously, still early in the fiscal year, which runs through next June, but September is a big month for tax collections, and so it is good news that we're off to a good start in that regard.
What's usually the reason that's given for revenue projections to be up or down? Do you as a legislator hear the reasons? Do you on a regular basis, are you updated where they're saying, well, our projections were off, or, right, we didn't get in the capital gains taxes that we expected? What do you hear?
Yeah, so absolutely great questions. And so I'm a member of the Ways and Means Committee, which is sort of the chief budget writing committee, mm-hmm, for the state. And so, I have a good window into this whole process, which is something I was added onto this committee this session. So it's been a great experience for me. Get to travel around the state. I've been to budget hearings out in Central Mass, up in the North Shore, even as far out as Amherst. There are a variety of different income sources, and some of them are much more cyclical, like capital gains tax, for instance. One of the things we've seen this year, though, is with withholding taxes and quarterly tax payments that a lot of businesses make. Those were below benchmark, and that we think that has something to do with some of the uncertainty in Washington, D.C., and businesses trying to take advantage of maybe some perceived tax breaks that are going to come down the road at the federal level. So that is, again, has an impact down here. Some of the changes in proposed about health care can have an impact on our revenues here. So those are a few things, but obviously when you're talking about a $40 billion budget, even a modest change can have an impact in particular revenues. So far, so good. And to answer your question, the Department of Revenue has every month they put out detailed reports. I have the top page of one of them here with me, and they look at this very, very carefully, obviously, because that's their job. In fact, they do it mid month as well. They put out a mid month report, and then they put out an end of month report as well. So we read those over just to kind of stay abreast. But like anything, you know, you don't want to get too up or too down, because it's the long haul that matters.
Okay. I recently did a story with State Senator Vinny DiMaceto in regards to his being named a co-chair to a special task force when it comes to a local retail. And so when I see this in regards to your...
We had a good time the other night. By the way, put in a plug for PAC TV. I don't know, is that a competitor of yours here? Can we mention them? But
no, they're actually a media partner.
Oh, good. Well, they did a telethon.
Yes.
For hurricane relief,
right.
And we had our whole South Shore contingent, including Senator DiMaceto and Representative Matt Muratori was the MC, and we had a good time answering the phones as people made donations. Sitting next to Representative
Amanda Fallbank.
We manned the phone bank, yeah. Rep called to us to my left. Treasurer O'Brien was behind me, and Vinny was there, and we had the whole South Shore team. So
there was a little bit of a little legislative competition to see who could get the most
absolutely.
Donations.
In fact, absolutely there was. We have a good time anytime we get together.
Do we name a winner, or was that...
I'm not going to reveal that.
Okay. I thought I would ask. Well, again...
I'm sorry. I got you off track. You're talking
about... You didn't get me off track, but it bears mentioning
doing my
that
best.
This was monies that was raised to help those who were affected by the hurricanes, Irma, Harvey,
and down in
Maria.
Puerto Rico as well. Yep.
Correct. And I think it was and we talked about this last week with the state senator, and it was $25,000 or somewhere in the vicinity.
So
of
they've
it.
Raised over, I believe it's up to $29,000.
Is it good?
Yep.
Excellent.
Yep. I think that night they raised around $25,000, but some donations have come in. We all donated some money ourselves. The Rotary Club made a sizable donation. A number of other generous folks came forward.
Right, so. And this is a Rotary thing where the monies that are gathered by the local Rotary here, the Plymouth Rotary, those monies will be handed off to the Rotaries down in those affected areas.
Yep, and we did it that way, Kevin, so that 100% of all the money that was donated would go directly to the affected folks. There's no administrative costs. There's no, there's nothing. 100% goes to the folks who needed it. So that was another big selling point of the telephone.
Well, I mentioned Vinny DiMaceto because I know that, again, talking with him about being a co-chair on that retail, that task force that's going to look to help retail, local retail, knowing that he also was part of this small business listening tour that took place, and being that you're somebody who is on the Joint Committee of Community Development and Small Business, what's going on in regards to small business, some of the things that you've been able to gather for intel in regards to being able to help the small businesses in the Commonwealth?
Yeah, so we had, it was great, we had our committee, so I serve, I'm the vice chair of the Small Business Committee, and so we had our committee come down to the South Shore for a listening tour, something we've done in a few other areas of the state, and obviously I wanted to make sure we did it down here in our district and the South Shore, and it just so happens that Senator DiMaceto and actually Representative Calter and Representative Joan Moschino are all members of the committee as well, so we teamed up. And so we had the committee members, the chairman and staff and other legislators, and we had folks from as far away as Springfield, Provincetown, and we had some North Shore folks as well, so it was a good spread of legislators. And we did a half-day tour. We went and visited a local bakery in Duxbury, French Memories, which still makes their croissants on site. So we got to see what that was all about.
I have
about.
A gift card for there.
Yeah, well, you should definitely...
I'm going to.
Definitely use it. And so that was really fascinating to kind of see the whole process, on a small scale, the manufacturing process for doing that. And one of the things we heard, both at French Memories and also we went and visited, obviously, one of our favorite local businesses, Tiny & Sons. My boys, do a great job. No visit to the South Shore would be complete without a visit to Tiny & Sons. We got to see how the auto glass replacement process works. And in between, we went and visited Island Creek Oysters, which is a well-known business here on the South Shore. Does a tremendous business with oysters. Has really put South Shore on the map in terms of oysters. I was actually, quick side note, I was on a family trip in Toronto up in Canada. We went to Niagara Falls and went up to Canada. And we randomly were in this nice little part of Toronto, randomly walked by a restaurant, looked at the menu, and Duxbury oysters were on the menu. So, just, you never know.
The taste of home.
I thought that was pretty cool, yeah.
The taste
so,
of home.
anyway, the lesson from all that, Kevin, was that in talking to these business folks, was this, we heard the same thing actually at all three places, and it was a little surprising to me, was that everybody said we're having trouble finding qualified help, and you know, we just can't fill all the jobs that we need with the people who have the right skills.
Right.
And that was kind of a little surprising to me that was the case. And so, but it was consistent. It was auto glass or making croissants. Finding people who had the right skills, you know, was a challenge for folks who are running businesses. So that was a lesson I think we take back, that I'll take back to the State House. And, you know, I'll try to take a look at that and see if there's ways we can help to make a difference there.
Is that something where maybe you tap the Votex to see if this is something that can, whether it's funding or find programs within the Votex that will
help? Yeah, I think absolutely. The Votex and the community colleges. I mean, that would be the first two places I would think of, would be, you know, trying to find ways to tap into that. And we have a great Votex system. We have the South Shore Votex School here in Hanover, which does a great job. And we have, you know, different community colleges, Massasoit in Brockton and other Quincy College, which is in Plymouth. So those are the obvious kind of places to go to, because those are the kind of, you know, places where folks can learn those skills. But, you know, it tells you something. There's good jobs out there that, you know, pay, you know, decent wages. You know, they're just not being filled all the time because we people don't have all the skills. So it's a so-called middle skills job, I think we call it. Doesn't necessarily require a four-year college degree, but may require some learning beyond just high school. But you can make a, you know, good middle-class living with that. And so we want to make sure folks who want to fill those jobs that they can, you know, have those skills, and we can help these, you know, our local businesses.
To help those businesses to continue
to
grow.
Right.
Final conversation. Again, we're speaking with State Representative Josh Cutler, who is our guest for this first segment. House Bill number 762. I got House Docket number 1058.
That's a whole lot of numbers, Kevin.
It's a whole lot of numbers, but it's a whole lot of good for a guy like me. I believe this is the Media Shield bill.
Yes.
And I got to say, one of the first lines in the bill itself, for the purposes of this section, the following terms shall have the following meanings.
Kevin, I'm just going to warn you, if you're going to read the bill, we're going to lose all of our listenership.
No. I'm just going to, just one more sentence, I promise. One more. Covered person, any person who is or has been an employee, agent, or independent contractor of any news media, as defined here, who has been engaged in bona fide news gathering for such entity. I just thought it was funny because in today's world where, you know, things are deemed fake news, alternative facts, and stuff like that, I thought it was interesting to see that as one of the first sentences. Talk to me about the purpose of this particular bill.
Well, so obviously, we, you know, in talking about the news, you know, I come from that background, and so obviously we respect the important role that the news media plays.
Right.
We don't always agree, but we certainly respect that role, and I think that more than ever has been is as important as ever. And before I grab into that, I just wanted to mention, talking about the media, here at WATD, the Talking Information Center provides a wonderful resource for folks who are trying to get their media, who may be hearing impaired or visually impaired. And and TIC, I know, does a great job in providing that. And every year, and especially this year, we've really run into some budgetary challenges in terms of trying to make sure the state continues to fund a portion of that to keep TIC on the air. Not just here on the South Shore, but I believe there's at least 7 or 8 affiliates around Massachusetts where folks can get that same coverage and programming, not just here on the South Shore. So that is important. We had a good event at the State House recently. I know Christine James and all the crew from WATD was there.
Lawrence was there.
Yep.
Larry Nelson was there.
Yep, the one and only, to kind of share the word about what's going on. Mm-hmm. And we had folks from all over the state, again, just to prove the point that this is a service that
is a valuable service
to many folks. Not just here on the South Shore. So I think that's important. I wanted to just thank WATD for all the work that you do to promote that. I know we've fought hard, and I know Representative Cantwell, my colleague at Marshall, has done a tremendous job on this, and successfully so, such that this year it is going to be in the budget. It wasn't originally, and I was at a couple meetings that were very contentious, and I can't really talk about them, but it was not always going to be in the budget. And because of the hard work of Representative Cantwell and Senator DiMacedo and WATD and all the folks here, it is now going to be funded again, and that is...
But it sounds like it's going to be an annual fight.
It is going to be an annual fight, I think.
As the belt gets tightened more and more every year.
It is true, so. And so we need to make our case. So that was my aside.
We've got a little less than time, 2 minutes left here, yes. If you will, kind of give us the details of this bill. What is the Media Shield?
So the Media Shield bill, which is something I filed, 40 other states have something similar, Kevin. And basically, it is a protection for folks who may be what we call them whistleblowers, who want to come forward and share their story about whatever particular information or insight they may have, to protect their identities. So if someone were to come forward to you with some compelling information about a news story that was of vital interest to the listeners here on the South mm-hmm. Shore and was concerned about their protecting their identity for obvious reasons, they could be fired or subject to harassment or whatever the case may be, you would want to be able to assure them that you would protect their information. And unfortunately here in Massachusetts, there isn't really a clear protection right now. There's some court cases on this topic that provide some degree of protection, but there isn't any kind of clear-cut media shield as there is in 40 other states. So if we were to have something like this, someone could come forward and you could then report on the story as you normally would with your good judgment. And if later on someone were to try to force you to reveal who the name of that person was, you would be protected, you would be privileged. So this has proven successful in a number of other states. Again, it's about protecting, it's called the Free Flow of Information Act, and it's about really making sure that people can feel comfortable to come forward and share information, and so that we don't lose stories or we don't lose items that should be in the public domain and serve the public. And so
where does it stand at this moment? Is it in committee?
So it actually had a hearing today. Before the Judiciary Committee. I know. What time? How do you pull this off, Kevin? It's amazing.
If you have a rabbit, you use it.
So, just today, this had a hearing, and it's something I've been working on for a little while now, and we're going to continue to do that. But it's, I think it's an important thing to do. It's not something that probably gets a lot of headlines, but, it's one of those behind-the-scenes kind of bills that I think is important about protecting public information and the public's right to know.
Okay. Well, you'll keep us up to date as it makes progress.
I will.
Anything in closing in regards to any upcoming events, or maybe let folks know how people in district, how they can get in touch with you?
Yes. Thanks, Kevin. I appreciate the time. As always, it goes by quick.
Yes.
But if folks want to reach me, you can always reach me in cyberspace at joshcutler.com. I have recently expanded my office hours. I do twice a month at every local senior center in my district. So twice a month in Duxbury, twice a month in Hanson and in Pembroke. Folks can come to my office hours or reach me at the State House or on Twitter or on Facebook or you name it.
It's easy.
I'm happy to hear from folks. And again, thank you for tuning in this evening. And thank you, Kevin, for doing such a darn good job. Well,
trying like hell. We are going to step aside. And when we come back, we'll speak with Weymouth Mayor Bob Hedlund. Right here, 95.9 WATD. Don't go anywhere.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Ever wonder about the possibility of harm from space aliens? What if a cylinder from Mars landed in your driveway and the top unscrewed?
Suddenly, the lid fell off.
Just when you decided to stay around, just when you thought it might be all right after all,
two luminous, disc-like eyes appeared above the rim. A huge, rounded bulk, larger than a bear, rose up slowly, glistening like wet leather. Its lipless mouth quivered and slapped, and snake-like tentacles writhed as the clumsy body heaved and pulsated.
Imagine what could happen to your windshield.
We're tiny infants, and my boys do a good job.
My dad did a great job. 1-888-64-TINIES. Just call.
Monday
Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 95.9WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, we are back here on Monday Night Talk, and joining us is the gentleman who got this whole ball rolling back many years ago as the original host of Monday Night Talk. Now, he is the mayor of Weymouth, former state senator. We have Mr. Bob Hedlund joining us. Mayor, how are you?
Good, Kev. So it's quite the launching pad. You know, you never know what's in store for you after hosting the show.
Yeah, it's funny. Is just the radio. Radio is my oyster, and it's just a matter of how big of a pearl I'm going to be able to harvest out of this someday.
Here you go.
Well, I want to give I've been trying to for these many years that since I have taken the mantle from you, and run with it. Is to make sure that it's a megaphone for folks to get on here and kind of talk about things that are going on. It's turned more into a news magazine type of a show and not necessarily, the many things that you have compiled in your head and all the historical facts and every concert that you've been to since 1972. This particular conversation that I'm looking forward to. There's a number of things that are going on in and around your community that I looking forward to giving you an opportunity. Probably the first one that I wanted to kind of just throw out there.
It'd be 1977, by the way, was my first one.
I was being facetious, but that's okay. And what was that show? What was the concert?
You want to know? You know I have an encyclopedic-like mind when it comes to rock concerts.
You do. It's amazing.
I don't know what it is, but I can tell you like what year, who I was with, highlights of the show. My first show was Lynyrd Skynyrd, Cape Cod Coliseum. The Street Survivors album was imminent, and it was just prior to the plane crash. In fact, the plane crash happened on that tour later. But I never could remember who the opening act was, and I just learned recently it was a band called Grinder Switch. You remember them?
I do not, but you obviously do.
I couldn't tell you one Grinder Switch song.
They were a southern rock band.
I mean, they were actually the referenced, I think, in Charlie Daniels' song "The South's Gonna Do It Again."
Okay,
they had some notoriety, but I just don't remember anything they did.
You know, over the past couple of years, we have lost a lot of great musicians. Most recently, Tom Petty. Any thought on Tom Petty at all? Did you follow Tom?
Yeah, I was a huge Tom Petty fan as a high school kid. I have a song that puts you in a place in time. I was pumping gas at J.R. Souza's gas station, B.P. Souza, downtown Hingham, where the old decrepit Settles Glass building is now. It's fallen into disrepair. That's slated for redevelopment, I think. And there are two songs. Whenever I hear them, it puts me exactly at that gas station in 1978-79, Tom Petty, I Need to Know, was in heavy rotation on WBZ-FM, which you and I have talked about in the past.
We have.
And the other song, ironically, is Jethro Tull, Acres Wild. And WBZ-FM was on a taped format. And that song would come on after, the Tull song would come on right after the Petty song. So you knew what song was coming next, but whenever I hear those two songs, it puts me in that time and place. And I loved Petty. Later years, I didn't like him as much. I only saw him in concert once out at Great Woods, and I didn't like it, mainly because I didn't like the set list.
Okay.
Petty's one of those guys, if I could pick the set list, it would be killer. But like some of his stuff, meh. And some of the stuff I absolutely over-the-top love.
Okay. So you
kind of a mixed bag.
Okay, good. Definitely good to know. And I want to at least give you an opportunity to talk a little music, because you are a guy who, my God, every time I see you on social media, you're talking about an upcoming event that's going to be taking place locally, or you're going to a show up in Boston. So I want to give you
that's my outlet, Kev. That's my outlet, and I will be seeing the Psychedelic Furs this weekend, by the way.
Okay, good. Definitely good to know. Let's start things off. Probably the big story these days is Amazon and their expansion. And there's been a conversation, not only up in the Boston area, but even down here on the South Shore, that there might be a little bit of a lotting of Amazon to maybe take a look at Union Point. What's your thoughts? What are the conversations that you have heard? What do you know about this?
Well, I know in terms of the national scene, just what I read, but I can tell you that if the Northeast is in play, and specifically if Massachusetts is in play for Amazon, and we think it may be given, you know, their requirements and what they're looking for, and what amenities they're looking for, proximity to, you know, airports and eastern seaboard issues to get, you know, access to Europe, et cetera. We know they want some proximity to New York, but might not necessarily want to be in New York. So if, in fact, Massachusetts is in play, I think we only have the real, truly viable site. I know there's a lot of talk about Suffolk Downs, some talk about Worcester, but for a host of reasons that we can tell, those sites might not actually work. So if Massachusetts is in play, we're the site, as far as I'm concerned, and I think that others are concerned.
Well, they're talking 8 million square feet for the second headquarters. I mean, how big is Union Point, and is would there be any zoning issues if you were able to lure them to the site?
No, that's the thing about the site is there's no zoning issues. There's no site assembly issues. They could break ground literally, you know, in a matter of a couple of months if they wanted to. And in terms of the size, you would be able to accommodate Amazon at the Union Point site without really changing any of the existing plan. The Amazon full build-out would occupy about 18% of the developable land, not even the total site, but only 18% of the total developable land. So from a geography standpoint, it can be absorbed. Certainly there are other issues, transportation challenges, things like that, but you know, we're looking at a lot of unique elements in our proposal that we'll be submitting along with Abington and Rockland. Well, it's coming from the three towns.
Well, what kind of a boon could that be for the three communities if you are able to lure this giant into your backyard?
You know, I'm not an economist, not an urban planner, but I can tell you from a tax benefit standpoint for the town, it would be just beyond comprehension. Spinoff would be significant. Opportunity for employment, high-paying jobs for local residents, significant. So definitely a huge win, and that would be why, I think that's the reason why you see so many municipalities around the country vying for this.
Okay, and when do you expect to submit that proposal? When could this proposal be in the hands of Amazon's people?
I think over the next week it will be going out, week or so. We have a special selectmen's meeting joint with Rockland and Abington. I will be attending that and speaking, and that was called for the purposes of those towns actually signing the submission letter. And then on the 19th, we'll be having a press conference announcing where Union Point and LSTAR will be making some announcements about some of the inducements they would be offering as part of this effort.
Okay, good. Definitely good to know. Transitioning away, so we'll look forward to hearing, you know, the more information in regards to the proposal and where things stand coming up this week. Probably the other thing that I would throw at you, and I think it has something to do with Union Point, is the work that's going to be done, or that should be starting relatively soon, if it hasn't already, is the widening of Route 18 in Weymouth and Abington.
Yeah, something that's been on the drawing board since the 1970s. Part of the Route 18 widening has been completed. This would be the last portion of this. Certainly essential to, it's not a panacea by any means, but it's essential to the future of Union Point. So this is something that's a four-year project and is now underway.
And this, so this is what will entail in the widening itself.
Yeah, there are areas where you have lane drops where previous widening had occurred, but then there's lane drops, so they create kind of choke points. One of the choke points is the railroad bridge in South Weymouth.
Mm-hmm.
That is the significant portion of this. That bridge will have to be replaced. Utility relocation, and you know what makes it challenging for the contractor is, you know, keeping the road open while all this is going on. There will be a closure of Route 18 for the railroad bridge replacement at times, There'll be some impacts on secondary roads, obviously. So it's something we have to contend with.
You know, during your answer there, you mentioned the word bridge. And the first thing I think of is the Four River Bridge. I know that right. This is something that has been, you know, long awaited, the opening and the near completion. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a milestone. Talk about another long-awaited project. that project has paralleled my entire public service career. It was an issue when I came into office. Mm-hmm. We had, obviously, some roadblocks along the way. You know, the scope of the project had to change when they discovered that the footings of the bridge needed to be replaced. They thought they were going to get by with the old footings. We had some defective workmanship from a subcontractor from down south. That cost us a year. So lots of stops and starts. A lot of angst over design. I think the design fears have been allayed. The safety element is just huge difference from the old bridge. You know, we had grates that were slippery in wet weather on the old bridge. This is paved the entire way. So the safety is enhanced. The opening and closing time of the bridge is much quicker. With the span of the bridge coupled with some dredging that's occurred, we expect less openings. So overall, it's definitely a relief for those who traverse the bridge and utilize Bridge Street Route 3A.
Now, have you had your chance to drive over it and kind of marvel at it, or is it kind of been there, done that type of a thing where you've probably done groundbreakings and been watching it as it has evolved and as they've torn down the old bridge?
You know, I won't say marvel at it, but it's definitely an improvement. We had a press conference announcing the lane opening that the state held on the Quincy side. I actually took my kid and we biked to the press conference. But I can say it's much more bicycle friendly than the old bridge and the temporary bridge. Great view from up there. A lot of people have actually just kind of walked up there to take in the view. You see residents, North Weymouth residents, walking up there all the time now.
Sure.
So it's much less foreboding and much more welcoming. The one thing I kind of miss about the old bridge, and I guess I'm sentimental, you know, as a kid, when you got trapped in the traffic, you could get out and kind of go look and watch the tankers go through, or even the ships that were going in and out of the shipyard that may have been in for repairs or built some of the battle, you know, old warships.
Sure.
It's a little less accessible for getting out of your car and viewing passing ship traffic. There's much more boring ship traffic these days than when the shipyard was open. But other than that, it's great.
Okay, we're speaking with Weymouth Mayor Bob Hedlund, a good friend of the show. He's the guy who started Monday Night Talk, and chatting with us about some of the ongoing things going on in Weymouth and in surrounding communities. I want to kind of stay with, we talked earlier about zoning and talked about Union Point, and I asked about zoning. One of the other little tidbits that I when I was digging for news and things for you and I to talk about was the thought to do a zoning change to kind of help commercial growth, that it seems to be choked off because of the zoning laws that are in place in the community. Talk to me about that if you could.
Yeah, so we haven't updated much zoning. There's elements of our zoning that have been in place since the 50s, and we think very outdated. The first thing we did, actually, was take some steps to further protect our remaining residential areas and eliminate some pork chop lot loopholes and things like that. That was our first step, and then we looked at our commercial zone, the commercial corridors. The Weymouth Landing had undergone a zoning change back in 2008. A lot of work went into that, and that is bearing a lot of fruit. So we kind of took that as an example of what we think the market is demanding or looking for, and trying to create that same level of success we've had in the Landing. And so far, so good. We've been out with probably 5 community meetings. It's been well received by town council, by residents groups, neighborhood associations, et cetera. And I can tell you the business community's ginned up. We're already seeing a multitude of proposals come in that once these zoning changes take effect, I think you'll see a lot of action on a lot of blighted properties that aren't being used to the highest and best use that will be redeveloped and will be a boon for our commercial tax base, which we sorely need. We don't have the commercial base of a Braintree and some of the other, you know, tax revenue sources, places like Braintree and Quincy and Hingham have. So we need that. We think it's going to spur that, and we're excited about it.
As far as the zoning, what will be required to complete the zoning change? Is this a matter of a vote? Is this a matter of a bylaw? Is the bylaw something that has to be voted on by Weymouth residents, or is it something that's invoked into the town charter?
Under our form of government, it would be you have to approve by the town council.
Okay.
So we're taking input now from the groups I mentioned and putting some finishing touches on that later this year. It will be submitted to the town council, you know, as a bylaw ordinance change, and we go from there.
You know, it's
we're hoping to finish it up and have it in place by the end of the year.
Okay, you talked about the town council just a couple of weeks from now. You got elections in town. How closely are you watching it, and how intrigued are you in regards to any of the issues that are being discussed by some of the folks, whether they're running for school committee or running for town council?
There's some competition. You know, we have two town councilors leaving. We'll have at least two new faces, if not more. More active school committee race on. And actually, give you an idea of the exciting life I lead. I actually stayed up last night and watched the tape of the school committee candidates forum. Some of the forums have been kind of a little staid, you know, not too lively back and forth. But nonetheless, it does give you an opportunity to get to know some of the candidates. We have some good candidates and maybe some not so good candidates, but nonetheless, the choice is being offered to the voters.
And the idea is that depending on what happens, it's November 7th for your community, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Depending on what happens on November 7th, it's kind of good to do a little homework on some of these individuals who are running, because you could be working hand in hand with them for the next couple of years.
Correct. And November 7th, tough date, bad timing. You know, I was going to try to see if we could move the election to accommodate the premiere of the Ric Flair ESPN piece coming out.
Yeah, I forgot you were a wrestling guy, too. I forgot all about that, and knowing that
I'm an old wrestling guy, but I had the opportunity to hang out with Ric Flair a couple of times, so I'm looking forward to this. And as you know, he has been very ill lately and was in a coma. We kidded around about him a little bit on the show in the past. Just for the record, I cannot stand watching WWE. I obviously did as a kid and parts of my adult life, but it's unwatchable these days, in my opinion.
Well, it's changed. It has changed so drastically in a lot of the rivalries, and, you know, you'd have the heels and the baby faces. It has changed a lot, and there's a lot of writing. It's not a matter like having, you know, Dorchester Pete Doherty coming down with the one tooth and, you know, banging it out with whoever he was put up against that night. You know, it's so different.
I saw him wrestle at the Hull High School Gymnasium, 1981.
Yeah, I remember my dad taking me to the old garden, and I would have the obstructed view with the supports, and I'd be like, I can't see. He's like, you're in the building. Don't, you know what? Just listen. Like, okay. But it was fun to see him come down. He'll come down through the crowd and go into the ring, and at least here, you know. And then back then, you'd have the I don't know what the proper word is, but back then it was called midget wrestlers. They would come in and, you know, they'd throw each other around, and it was fun and entertainment. It was, you know,
Milo, Low, Little Beaver, and the best part of it, Kev, was, you know, most of the fans were in character too, thinking that it was real.
Right. And now these days they've realized that it's sports entertainment,
which is taking a little of the fun out of it. You know, you wanted to hate the Iron Sheik from Tehran, Iran, or Nikolai Volkov from the Soviet Union, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, and, you know, Mr. Fuji, you know, these were characters that, you know, as much as you loved certain good guys or baby faces, you know, you wanted to hate so much those villains, you know?
Mr. Fuji just passed away.
He did. And not too long ago, we had Bob Backlund in the studio here. You missed it.
Oh, I saw that, and, you know, I ran into him at the St. Patrick's Day Parade in South Boston. He was just wandering around.
It was
very strange.
I got to tell you, though, he is such a lovable and personable guy.
Is he playing with a full deck these days, or what?
I think he's okay. I think, don't forget, he also he changed from being that all-American guy and being the champion a couple of times to... They slowly tweaked his character where he was he kind of went off the rails, you know, with the wild chicken wing, you know, the bare-faced chicken wing. Very interesting.
Yeah, I'll leave you with one quick Mr. Fuji story because, you know, in the early days of Monday Night Talk, we always had Dave Wedge on, and we talked a lot about newspapers.
Sure.
Dave, of course, had been with the Herald. But growing up, and he's actually still a columnist, eh? He's been there for 40 years, but Joe Fitzgerald started out as a sports columnist in the Herald. Now he just does a straight column.
Yep.
This is like a morality column or something. But the old WWF would come to the Boston Garden once a month, and he'd write a column every Saturday, and if it was the Saturday of the night of the WWF matches, he would always close his column by saying, if you see Mr. Fuji, tell him, if you see Mr. Fuji today, tell him Joe Fitzgerald says hi.
Really?
Yeah, and it was just this running thing for, you know, a decade. And I happened to be traveling on Route 95, and I was stuck in a traffic jam. This is in the 90s, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I was stuck in a traffic jam on the George Washington Bridge. And all of a sudden, I looked to my left. It was a warm day, and the windows were down, like a Lincoln Continental. And Mr. Fuji was driving the car. And he was next to me. He was stuck in the traffic next to me with the windows down. And in the back seat were the Hebner twins. And in the other front seat was some wrestler guy. I forget who it was. It was a lesser star. And I just couldn't help myself, so I yelled over to him, hey, Mr. Fuji, Joe Fitzgerald says hello.
And what did he say back?
He just grinned.
That's definitely fantastic. And only you would be fortunate enough to cross his path and be... you know, quick enough to throw that out there and at least gain some kind of reaction back from him.
If Joe Fitzgerald was writing that for 10 years, I would suspect that, and this is pre-internet, obviously, when people read newspapers, that more than one person probably said that to Mr. Fuji.
Yeah, he probably heard it on a regular basis, that is for sure. Mara, I want to thank you so much for joining us. We're going to step aside, but coming up, we're going to talk a little baseball, and we're not going to talk Phillies or anything, but we're going to talk about the Red Sox and the season that was. So,
hey, this past week I met Curt Schilling, ran into him, and Louis Tiant in the same week.
Too bad your son didn't realize who he was meeting.
I know. Schilling was very intense. When I talked to him, I kind of took him on a little baseball trivia, and he took it quite seriously.
Not a bad thing, though. Do you think he belongs? Does he belong in the Hall of Fame?
You know, I initially said no at first blush, but some of his statistics are pretty impressive in terms of And I'm not one of these guys that say, "Oh, he did this and that in the postseason." Mm. But you know, some of the get beyond win loss ERA, but his walks, hits per inning stuff, the strikeout ratio. I mean, he's up there in the all-time leaders. I've come around on him and have to say yes.
He deserves it. I think he helped deliver, World Series here.
Not just here. I mean, he was a winner everywhere he went. Phillies staff in 93, yep. And then with the NL champs, Arizona. Yeah. World championship there, Boston.
Oh, hard to believe that the Sox traded him away. As a young pitcher.
Yeah, was that the was it him and Brady Anderson?
It was the Brady Anderson trade. That is correct. Yep.
Right, and then Houston picked him up, and then the Phillies got him in a steal of a deal, I think, too, from Houston.
Yeah, I think he moved on. Did he move on to Arizona after that?
Yeah. He did a long run. People forget about his time and. He threw up some great numbers in Philadelphia because although he won a NL championship with Philly, a lot of those years were really bad, were terrible Phillies teams.
Yep.
You know, he didn't have a lot of support.
Yeah, and well, the other thing is I wonder if they'll have an issue with the number of wins. And is it a threshold that some pitchers need to cross in order to be considered, worthy of the Baseball Hall of Fame?
There are pitchers in there with less wins than him.
Oh, yeah?
And wins have become less of a criteria with all these sabermetric guys. But what has hurt him is politics.
Politics.
His vote total actually went down after his supposed controversial comments on ESPN.
Yep. Well, thank you, Mayor, for joining us. We'll look forward to having you on again in the near future and chatting more about what's going on in Weymouth and other things that both you and I enjoy.
We covered it all, from Four Over Bridge to Ric Flair. I love it.
Woo! All right, there we go. We are going to step aside, and when we come back, the second hour of Monday Night Talk, right here at 959 WATD. Don't go anywhere.
The South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Hour number two. And we will speak later on during the hour to Topher Morrison. He is the author of the book of public speaking. Not the book or his book, but it's called The Book on Public Speaking. Be a great conversation. Guy has more than three decades of experience when it comes to this. Looking forward to chatting with him. Even someone who pretends to be a professional like myself looks forward to talking to him and getting some tips and had a chance to peruse the book. Fantastic book. We'll talk with him. But we start with WATD. What's your are you a sports reporter? Are you a sports anchor?
I like to go by sports reporter.
Okay, so WATD sports reporter. He also pens for the Boston Herald.
Correct.
Anybody else? Who else are you?
Freelance occasionally for the Enterprise and for the Patriot Ledger.
We don't mention them.
Yeah.
Not a fan of this. You can talk about the Globe. No, I'm kidding. But we get Brendan Connolly, who is here. And that I would bring him in to talk a little bit about the Boston. We were trying to get other individuals to be a part of the mix. But I told Brendan that if it was just us two,
we could handle it.
We could handle it. But, you know, you have bring somebody in from maybe like a Barstool or somebody from one of the other bigger radio stations, Boston area radio stations. But, well, you and I could handle it. And knowing that you've done regular reports, you're up in the Boston area now. Every time I turn around, if you're not at a Patriots press conference, you're at a Red Sox press conference. And soon you're going to be at, you know, Bruins or Celtics.
Already have been to the Bruins. Their season's already underway. I can't believe
that Malcolm Subban shut him out.
That is pretty awful, in my opinion.
And Malcolm couldn't stop a puck when he was here.
Statistically, when he was in Boston, Malcolm Subban, this is actually proven. His stats were so god-awful. Mm. They rated him as one of the worst goalies in history. And then he goes out, coincidentally, his first game against the Bruins, and pretty much shuts him out for three periods, and then they get a late goal, but it doesn't matter in the end.
Doesn't matter, yeah. Yeah, it was a tough, and it seems as though that the Golden Knights, the Vegas Golden Knights,
they're on fire.
Yeah, decent team. I think they're 4-1 in that division already.
They did well with their expansion draft of the players that they had at their disposal, and so far it's worked out. Do I think they can keep this streak up? No.
Okay.
But, hey, it's a great story anyway.
We'll see what happens. But the purpose for Brendan being here is just want to kind of get his thoughts on the Boston Red Sox. I thought it was very interesting that John Farrell was let go just a couple of days ago. Oddly enough, this is a gentleman who led the Sox to first-place finishes in the AL East.
And a World Series.
And a World Series. But he also had a couple of
dud seasons.
Back-to-back last-place finishes. So, the Dave Dombrowski, being the guy who oversees baseball operations for the Sox, said, well, we're going to have to let you go.
And I think it came a year too late. I think in terms of John Farrell, he put the organization in a tough situation, I should say. No fault of his own. He was diagnosed with cancer, mm-hmm. as we know, during one of their last play seasons. So that while he's getting treatment, Torrey Lovello steps up and leads the team to a pretty, I wouldn't say last place is respectable, but they were not on pace to be what they ended up at during that season. Yeah, and then the following season, they kept him on board as just kind of that place guy in case something did happen to Farrell, and they ended up finishing in first place. And now they had to let Torrey Lovello walk. He goes to Arizona and turns Arizona from a pretty much a bottom seller team into a top contender. And now they let go of Farrell, and now they have nothing. So it's kind of a rough ending for them. We'll see what goes on. Obviously, I'm sure you're trying to have me here to talk some more of the manager candidates out there.
Yeah, who do you think? I mean, Alex Cora.
That seems to be the hot name.
He's the hot name bench coach for the Houston Astros. Was a great player. A good, serviceable,
solid player.
A utility player, but he was a guy who he did well.
And I think the reason his name is so hot is because obviously he playing in Boston for a few years, knows what the media expects. Mm-hmm. He's been a coach at a lower level and as an assistant in the majors. So he has the experience. I'm not as big of a fan of the name as a lot of people are, but
Who would you like to see?
See, there's another name out there that I don't want to see, but I'll
Bobby Valentine.
Well, yeah.
Oh, no, wait, that already happened.
Then there are names like
Ron Gardenhire.
That's a good name, I think. I think Rod Gardenhire, he didn't really stick out in Minnesota, but he led them to at least the playoffs a good chunk of his years there. Has been a ton of Major League Baseball experience managing. Mm-hmm. Minnesota, obviously not as big of a market as Boston, but it's still being in the limelight as long as he was. That's a good name. Do I think he could adjust here? I think he could. I think there are some other names out there taking wild shots here. Who knows? You give Tony La Russa a call. I don't know if he's going to come out of retirement. But, hey, there are some bigger names out there. Alex Cora is kind of low risk, but I don't think it's as high of a reward as everyone's saying it is.
There's also talk about Jason Varitek, but one of the prerequisites for
Dombrowski.
So for Dombrowski is that whomever they pick to be the next Sox skipper
has to have been a skipper.
Right. So do you look in-house? Is Gary DeSarcina a guy that you would tap?
I'm sure DeSarcina is on the list of candidates for the Red Sox, but do I see him being that next guy? I don't see it. I did hear that Dombrowski wants to keep a good chunk of who he has on the staff already in-house.
You mean Chili Davis is safe?
Yeah, apparently. That's one rumor I heard.
Okay. Would you make him skipper?
No.
Okay.
I wouldn't make Chili Davis my skipper.
I wasn't, you know what, the year prior when the Sox had Ortiz.
And their offense looked legit.
It looked legit, but without Ortiz, you know, you had a team that batted, what would they have a team average? They might have been about upper 250s, 260-ish.
With Ortiz,
they were around
about 290, 280.
No, they're about 275, 280 batting as a team, at batting average as a team.
Yeah, and then it dropped, obviously. They still were hitting the ball. The thing was, the power was gone. Mm. They finished, I think it was dead last in home runs, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
It's pretty awful. I could see them going out this offseason. Question is, how high do they want to go price-wise? Do you trade for a guy like Giancarlo Stanton? That's a high price, not just on his contract.
325, 13 years.
60 home runs, though. That's the key. And then the only other thing is, do you want to deal?
Who do you subtract?
Yeah, exactly. Who do you want to part ways with? And you're going to have to give up something that hurts, like an Andrew Benintendi, to bring in a guy like Giancarlo Stanton.
Well, that's a great segue. How did you feel the rookies like Benintendi and Rafael Devers? Devers was that experiment when Pablo Sandoval went. You know, Pablo couldn't. He couldn't hit. He was having trouble fielding. They were like,
he couldn't do anything.
He couldn't do anything.
So Devers, I love the potential with this guy. The short time he was up here was similar to that of a guy like who's the guy I'm looking for?
Benintendi
had a potential rookie of the year campaign. Unfortunately, I think he got outbeat by Aaron Judge solely because
overruled. Yes, you're right.
Exactly. Because Aaron Judge just seemed to put the ball into orbit every time he made contact and ended up slowly turning around that Yankees franchise, in my opinion.
Right. Home runs, RBI, should talk about it. He had a little bit of a slump in midseason, between, late July, August, early September.
Yeah, striking out a lot.
And he said, baseball is a series of slumps, and it's a matter, not everybody can hit at the same time. And people have to realize that. But Judge, I would say, he's the odds on American League Rookie of the Year. He has to be. He'll get it.
Then as for Devers, during his short time up here, he put up numbers, in my opinion, that were similar to, I think he'll do better than this player. I think this player hit his ceiling during this stretch. But he put up similar numbers to what Travis Shaw did during his last month of the season.
Is this Benintendi?
No, as Devers.
Oh, okay. Devers. Because I was going to say, with the one downer I had, I loved Benintendi's bat. I liked the skills in the outfield. But the kid can't run bases. He was every time I turned around, he was getting into. There was some kind of a miscue on the base paths.
I think that was one of the things that ended up dooming Farrell was those slight in-game decisions that ended up changing the course of games.
But if you heard any of the radio interviews or any of the interviews that were done that Dombrowski didn't care about an in-game manager, somebody like a Terry Francona who could take care of that stuff.
Yeah, I tend to hear what the guy says, but at the same time, I just can't believe it because otherwise, what else is there to look at for John Farrell other than his in-game managing, really, and his history in the clubhouse, which we shouldn't probably go too deep into. John Farrell, it seemed like they were making one bad mistake every couple of games that ended up costing them a game, and John Farrell always was a big fan of the aggressive base running. And seemed to try to drill that into Benintendi's head, and Benintendi, obviously, as we know, led the American League probably in some
on base errors, right? What do you feel that the Sox should do in the offseason? I mean, do they have enough arms? You got Stephen Wright, who will be coming back from his injury during the season, so you'll have him back.
I like the Red Sox rotation.
Price should be back. He should be back in the starting rotation. You don't have to worry about stretching him out because he'll have all winter to do that. What do you do?
I like the Red Sox rotation as it's constituted right now. The only there are some juicy names on the market. Like
who?
Jake Arrieta is going to be a free agent.
Yeah, but he sucked this year.
Still, compared
to the guy that you had, who was the defending Cy Young winner,
Rick Porcello.
Had a losing record. What was he like 10-17 or 11?
It was disgusting. It was ERA of the high fours, low fives, something like that.
He was stink bitten because when he would have a good outing, they wouldn't hit for him. They wouldn't get runs for him,
And then there's other names like Yu Darvish. I don't think the Sox need to add an arm, though, in my opinion. They already have such a deep starting rotation compared to most teams out there. That's one thing I don't think they really need to add it. If they wanted to, they could, but I don't see them doing it.
First base,
I could see them letting go of Mitch Moreland and bringing in, there's a couple names on the market.
Bring in somebody who can give you 25, 30, hit, 260.
Like J.D. Martinez, maybe?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, J.D. Martinez.
And that name has been thrown around. Being thrown around.
The only question I have with him is, can he keep up that consistency? Because this was kind of a breakout year for him, and he's already kind of up there in age. So you never know. You could bring in J.D. Martinez and let a guy like Mitch Moreland go. Mitch Moreland only was signed to a one-year, $12 million deal, if I believe. Trying to remember the exact details of the contract, but I don't think he's signed up for this year.
Who do you feel right now, the teams that are battling it out for the Fall Classic? Mm-hmm. You've got right now the Astros, they're playing tonight. They're up 2-0 over the Yanks. And Dodgers are up 2-0 over the defending World Series champion Chicago Cubs. Do you feel that it's going to be the Astros and the Dodgers?
Now, as for what I want to see happen, the dream scenario, in my opinion, for Major League Baseball, it could be either Yankees, Dodgers, or Yankees, Cubs. Both really big market teams. All three really big market teams. I don't believe, I want to see the Yankees in the World Series just so I can root against them in a high dramatic situation.
Okay.
But the Yankees, I don't think, have the power to overcome Houston. I think Houston is the better team. Is that the juiciest market going into the World Series? No, not in my opinion. But
okay, let's look at it realistically while we have a minute left here.
All right. So I think it's going to be Houston, and I think it's going to be it's a toss-up between L.A. and Chicago, even though L.A. is already ahead. L.A. took advantage of their home games. Let's see what Chicago does. If Chicago answers, I think they have a shot to win the whole thing and move on.
Okay, very good. We know that, again, you do coverage for other Boston-area sports teams. Celtics, very exciting to get the new big three. The group of players, the underachievers that Brad Stevens was coaching now are gone, and now you have... It's a whole new team. What, 11 of 15 players?
They're all gone. And the fact that they brought in Kyrie Irving, Gordon Hayward, this is what we know about the NBA. It's a star-driven league. Yep. If you don't have the superstar, you're not going to win the whole thing. The Celtics proved that you could go as far as you can with a group of average Joes and one okay to all-star player in Isaiah Thomas. But then they got their doors blown off when it came time to actually coming in.
But at least the Celtics have the clutch guy now.
They have Kyrie Irving, and they also have Gordon Hayward, who was a clutch guy in Utah, and Utah didn't get a lot of coverage, but during his time there, he was putting up big numbers. So I think the Celtics are going to be in, for my opinion. I said this, and you kind of jumped at me.
Give me a number. How many wins will they have?
I'm putting it exactly on 60 wins. Now, why do I originally, I would have said about 57 to 58, but because of how well they've done together as a group so far, so early in the season, in terms of preseason, it seems like they've already gelled, and everything's going well for this team going forward.
Two more questions. Again, we're speaking with the WATD sports reporter, Brendan Conley, who has been my guest for this segment. Do they make it to the conference finals? Do they make it to whomever comes out of the West? Do they make it to the championship, the Celtics?
The Celtics have definitely a good chance to make it to the conference finals. In fact, I think that's already set in stone. I think it's going to be them against Cleveland. Do I think they can beat Cleveland this time? We'll see. We'll see how the new Cleveland team looks. I think the Celtics have the talent to make it to the championship. I don't think they have enough to win the title this year, but that could change in the next years as the young talent develops.
Bruins make the playoffs or no?
Oh, they've done so poorly to start. I think they can squeak in again, though. Once Patrice Bergeron comes back, I think we'll see what the true Bruins team is. Yep.
All right, there he is, Brendan Conley. Be sure to listen in for his reports, whether you hear them during the day or during the South Shore's morning news.
Or South Shore's evening news, depending on what time it is.
Well, I just said that, but thank you very much for joining us. We're going to step aside. When we come back, we'll speak with Topher Morrison, talk about his new book. The book on public speaking. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Monday Night Talk.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Duct tape, oh, where is my duct tape? My window is cracked.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny and Sons Glass. If only duct tape were transparent. Seriously, little cracks must become big cracks. It's a law of physics. We can fix that. Insurance pays. Call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
My window is cracked.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
All right, welcome back to the final segment of Monday Night Talk. And I like to call this segment, or folks have deemed this segment, when I have a chance to speak with folks who have put their blood, sweat, and tears into writing, whether it's a short story, whether it's a book, whether it's a how-to, author's corner. We have an opportunity to speak with folks about, you know, something that they got out on the shelves, and that they're sharing with the world. And it's our opportunity to give those individuals a chance. I got to say, is the individual who's joining me this evening is a gentleman who has more than 30 years of experience as a professional speaker, a speaking coach, also a professor at the University of Tampa, and he is proudly releasing a new book called The Book on Public Speaking, and this is a great how-to, an attention getter. I've had a chance to kind of take a look at it, and there's some things in here that even a guy like me can learn from and be able to apply. And so joining us right now is none other than Mr. Topher Morrison, who's joining us. Welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, Kevin, how are you tonight?
I'm doing pretty good. I hope I gave you a...
I'm impressed. As a professional speaker, you're keeping the energy level high. You're keeping your listening audience attentive. Even in the last segment, your energy hasn't waned. I'll give you an A+. You're doing awesome.
I have to ask you, what was it that finally made you sit down and say, I want to take what I have shown people over these years, apply it to, you know, a book, a how-to?
Yeah, you know what? Over the past 30 years, the speaking profession is an interesting one because it seems to be one of the few professions that hasn't evolved hardly at all. Like, if you look at people that want to get up and speak, they kind of still walk and talk and sound like that 1980s motivational speaker.
Right.
You know, the funny thing is if an architect were designing houses today the way they did in the 1980s, or a fashion designer was designing clothes the way they did in the 80s, they'd be the laughing stock of their profession. And yet in the professional speaking world, everybody still kind of tried to walk and talk like that 1980s motivational guy. So I wanted to write a book that kind of got up in the face of that and said, listen, there's a better way to communicate in today's age, which doesn't have to make you walk and talk and sound like that typical 1980s motivational guy.
But, and there's a lot of key things. Now, the way I noticed your book is broken down into three different parts.
Three pieces, yeah.
Yeah, well, why is that?
Well, because I think so many times people focus too much on the presentation side of things, and they don't focus on the other aspects. Our technology, our society has evolved, and now professional speaking has gone off of the stage for those motivational speakers or those politicians or those athletes, and it's got down into people's homes. Podcasting is a great example, right? You know, 20 years ago, the only way we could hear thoughts like you and I sharing right now is if we tuned into the radio, but now anybody can have a podcast. And so I think the net has become much broader for people to be able to have these skills. But the sad thing is the majority of those people sit there and they go, well, I'm not a professional speaker, I just have a podcast. Or I'm not a professional speaker, I'm just a business owner. Well, if you have to get up and speak in front of people, whether it's on stage or in front of a microphone, or in front of your employees, in my opinion, you're a professional speaker because you better make sure you know how to communicate in the most effective way. So the three areas are on the stage, in front of the camera, and behind the desk. In other words, behind the desk is how do you prepare for the presentation, and then the two sections of stage and camera, or microphone for that matter, really have to do with the different nuances that don't work on camera but do work on stage, and do work on stage but don't work on camera or microphone.
So let's talk about that very first part. And you talk about being on stage. I kind of think of, if you're somebody who's up on stage, I'm going to equate it to another media part of the media field that I've worked in, and that is I've worked in print media. And we used to have our editors always told us, you want to be able to find, you have to grab your reader with your first 18 words. Your lead has to grab them and suck them in. If not, well then, you know what, they're going to move on to the next article. Would you say that if you're getting up on stage and you're doing a presentation, that your first set of words, your first paragraph has to be something that is going to capture your audience?
Yeah, you better believe it. In fact, I'll share with your listeners a great tip, because you just sparked on something really interesting, which is you talked about the literary world, and you've got to grab them with those first 18 words. Well, in the literary world, what's the best way to start a story? Once upon a time, right? If you look at all the great works, that's how they started. Well, guess what? That's also the best way to start a presentation. Now, you don't actually get up on stage and go, once upon a time, right? But if you can get up on stage and begin your presentation with some sort of contextual story in relationship to time, it's very engaging and it grabs people. So it might be something like, you know, if we were to rewind this presentation, I could say something to the effect of, hey, I've been listening to your presentation tonight. Great radio program. I love how you've been keeping the energy rolling and going. And I gave a contextual time comment to the introduction of this interview. In other words, I did a once upon a time. Once upon a time, Kevin started a radio show a little while ago, and he's been doing it on Monday night, and he started, and now this is the last segment. So that was the once upon a time that I did here. Same thing in any presentation. You know, yesterday I was at a grocery store, and all of a sudden I discovered that, you know what, there's way too many selections of cereal boxes, right? Whatever it is, right? You just start with a story, and people immediately get engaged, because we love stories.
How about body language? How important is body language when you are up and you are presenting, again, whether it's to a handful of people or if you're in an auditorium somewhere?
Well, I think it's critical. And I think everybody probably realizes that when you're on stage, you have to make sure you have the posture and the energy levels of somebody you'd want to watch as well as listen to. Mm. But the most important one is what you do as a professional. Now, I'm not in the studio with you right now. I can't see what you're doing. But I'm going to make a prediction, Kevin, that you are not laying on a couch with your feet crossed and throwing pencils up into the ceiling. You're probably sitting upright. You might even be leaning forward. You're leaning on a desk, perhaps, or sitting straight up. And you're probably even speaking with your hands, much like I am, and there's nobody here watching you. And if you realize that on radio or on podcasting or anything where they can't watch you, your body language is just as important when you're speaking to people who can't see you as it is for people who can.
That's very interesting, because that is true. That is what I'm doing. I am sitting up. I am talking a little bit with my hands, because that is my nature. And it is very much important. It's almost part of the entertainment that I'm providing,
sure,
as I'm educating,
yeah,
somebody, right?
Yes. The only benefit for us is that we can do it without our pants on, as opposed to speaking on stage. This is Pantsless Monday, right?
It is. It actually is. You're right. That is correct. Talk to me about the acronym LAME.
LAME, yeah. So one of the things that bothers me about professional speakers is that they love to create these acronyms like SUCCESS. S stands for start somewhere. U stands for only you can make a difference. And they do these kind of things where they love to have acronyms that stand for things.
Right.
And the challenge with those is it's just so been done. It's like a cliche. And if you want to get your audience to roll their eyes, the first thing you could do is sit there and get up and say, I've created a presentation called Leadership. L stands for, you know, and then just go into those things. It's been done so many times, it's really kind of lame, right?
Right.
And so I always tell people, I say, if you're going to have to use an acronym, use one that at least is unique and different. So, for example, I've got a client of mine, Alex Rodriguez. He wrote a book called Digital Bacon, which is just an awesome title for a book on digital marketing, how to create an irresistibly tasty marketing message, right? And he's got a 5-step methodology for product launches, and the acronym is BACON, B-A-C-O-N. At least that's a unique acronym to where it's not something like success, leadership, goals, or something like that. So the whole idea about don't be L-A-M-E is, you know, don't worry about using the average mundane words that everybody's heard 100 times over and over again.
How important is it to make sure that you have all your information, that you are well-prepared on stage for anything? Because not only myself, being somebody who, you know, is in front of the microphone, but I'm also, yeah, somebody who's a behind the scenes, and I'm ready at all costs. I have a plan B, C, and D. How important is it to be thoroughly prepared for being up on stage and for anything that might come your way, whether it's a question from the audience,
sure,
or being able to be approachable?
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing about that is the one objection that I hear, I mean, we all know we should prepare for a presentation.
Sure.
Right? We don't disagree with that. But the one argument I get against that time and time again is people say, well, I don't want to sound scripted or rehearsed. I like to let things unfold organically. And I always have to pause on, what the hell does that even mean, unfold organically, right? And they always think that it's best to just get up and improvise. And the challenge with that is it would be similar to like a musician getting up on stage and never once rehearsing what they're doing and then just getting up and winging it. The only musicians that can get up on stage and wing it are the ones who have rehearsed for tens, if not hundreds of thousands of hours. We look at a musician and they get up there, you know, and they can just run their hand along the frets of the guitar with such effortlessness and such ease that if they want to, they can actually pause. They can talk to the audience. They can add a couple of additional scales inside the musician, and they can actually improvise and make it look, quote-unquote, I guess, organic. But the only reason they can do that is because they've rehearsed it to such a level of perfection that they have the flexibility to be able to improvise. And I think this is the mistake that most speakers make, because they think that they should just be able to improvise from the moment they get on the microphone or get up on stage, and that's not true. Your improvisational skills, your ability to think on your feet and come up with things you've never thought before will be in direct proportion to how well you're prepared and how much you know what you're going to say before you say it, so you can always get back on track any given time. It's crucial if you want to actually sound like and look like you're kind of speaking off the cuff. That's what you do really well, Kevin. You make it sound like a conversation. You make it sound like you're just discovering things up front and having a great time. But yet there's a calculated rehearsal to that. You don't just wake up, drive to the studio, and then get on the radio. You put in, I'm going to guess, that you probably put in at least 2 to 3 hours of preparation for 1 hour that you're on the air.
It might be more than that, because I want to make sure that I'm giving the best to my audience, and I'm doing the best for the person who's taking their time to sit down and talk with me, whether it's in studio or whether it's on the phone.
Yeah, and that's what people need to do when they're delivering a presentation, whether it be to their employees or whether it be to a prospective client or an audience who's come to a networking organization to hear you speak. In my opinion, you owe it, just like you said, to your audience to give them the best that you possibly can be.
Okay, we're speaking with Topher Morrison, and he is talking about his new book, to help professionals deliver captivating and inspiring public presentations, and much, much more, I might add. Just kind of to read a little bit of one of the folks who actually weighed in on the book. Topher Morrison is one of the most powerful professional speakers in America, and this book reveals how he earned millions on stage, on camera, and in business. I strongly recommend that you read it. And that was Steve Seibold. He's a past chairman of the National Speakers Association Million Dollar Speakers Group. Is that correct?
Yeah. He's been a good friend of mine and a mentor over the years. He was a gentleman that I met later in my career when I thought I knew everything. Boy, did he show me a thing or two. I was humbled after I met the guy. He's a great speaker. One of the best I've ever seen in the business, actually.
Let's move on to part two. In the book, on camera. And one of the first things that I was able to kind of glean through was interviewing skills. Talk to me about the importance of one's interviewing skills and being able to ask the right questions and be able to get the most out of the interview.
Yeah, sure. So the interesting thing right now is that if you look at how we are assimilating information, we have a market that wants to consume information much faster than we can even produce it. You remember back in the old days when we had three channels, ABC, NBC, and CBS.
Right.
Well, those reporters, they might do 6 weeks of research before they ever aired any of the reports or their findings, because they did a really good job with that. Well, unfortunately, now the market is demanding that we get the information much quicker and much faster. So by the very nature of how fast we have to supply and provide content to our listening audience, whether that be our employees or our customers, it doesn't matter. There's no way you can assimilate. Just like if you think about what you do here on Monday nights, if you had to run the whole show by yourself with no guests, the amount of prep work would be way longer. But it's easier for you to go out and find individuals that have opinions on the relevant topics that you're looking for, so you can essentially, in many respects, I guess, outsource the responsibility of content flow to people that you interview. And I think if professionals realize that, they might even go, well, I don't own a podcast. I'm not a radio talk show host. I don't have my own TV show. I'm like, yeah, but you might want to think about it. You might want to think about how you could find professionals and then ask them and engage with really powerful interviews. You know, if you look at somebody like yourself, Kevin, who's a professional, you've done this in the business, you have techniques, you have systems to where you know when to interrupt when I've talked too long. You know when to give me the mic and let me roll.
Mm-hmm.
Amateurs that just get a podcast, they tend to not do that. And what they end up doing is they end up creating a very boring interview, which nobody wants to listen to. There's an art and a skill to make an interview sound entertaining, especially when they aren't. Right, you've probably had those in the past where you had your nightmare guests where you're like, oh my God, I feel like I'm talking with a bar of soap. And you have to work harder as the interviewer to come up with really cool questions or even dominate the conversation. One of my favorite examples of that, did you ever see the interview with David Letterman and Paris Hilton when she was on his show?
I did. That was a while ago, and I vaguely remember it, though. It was gritting.
It was painful.
Right? Yeah.
But he handled it with such grace, right? He knew how to control that conversation, point out the obvious that it was a nightmare interview, and he just did it really well. So I always tell people that are starting to do interviews from the very first time, it's not about having a preset list of questions. Yeah, you've done your research, right, Kevin? You know what you're going to probably ask me up front. But I would venture to say that probably a good third of the questions you've already asked me were not preordained. They weren't thought of. They were based upon what I've already said, and you dig a little bit deeper. And that's one of the keys to having a really good interview, is to actually go off script and keep going deeper.
Well, base questions usually will have, you know, the questions that can be generated from those. So it's kind of, you know, through osmosis, you learn that with your first interviews, that, you know, if you can have a series of questions, but you can have questions off of the answers that are given by your guest.
Yep, and that's what makes a conversation a conversation versus like some presentational dialogue. I often attribute it to the difference between, you know, like a traditional radio interview like we're doing now versus something on NPR.
Right.
NPR is known for very deep, great interviews, but boring, right? That's just not engaging, because it's almost like a slow motion tennis match, right? Where the question is asked, there's a pause, the answer is given, there's a pause. That's really boring.
Yeah.
You and I, man, we've been interrupting each other the whole time, and that's what makes a normal conversation a normal conversation.
Well, that's what makes me the host with the most, right?
There we go, brother. I like that.
Just stealing out of chapter 13, if you don't mind. Talk to me about guest skills. How important is it that whoever you have for a guest is somebody that you're able to have a give-and-take conversation with?
Yeah, sure. So this is an interesting one. Since I am your guest, I feel like I'm going meta on the whole conversation
right.
We're having here. But as a guest, you know, my opinion is this. When you're a guest on a show, it's never about promoting your own materials. It's about giving the audience such value that they keep listening. On a radio program, there's one objective, and that's to keep the listener listening. So it's not for me to sell my books. If that happens, that's great, but I want to add great value, keep your listeners entertained where they want to keep coming back. And here's why this is important. If at the end of this conversation, Kevin, you hang up this phone and you go, damn, that was entertaining. That guy was fun. I'd like him back. I've won. But if all I do is sell books, I'm never going to get invited back. Could you imagine how boring of an interview this would be? It's if every time you ask me a question, I say, well, if you turn to page 42 in chapter 3, I actually outlined this, and you should go pick up a copy on Amazon. It'd be like really so self-promotional. It's miserable. So I tell people that when you're a guest, you're there. You are that. You're a guest in someone's home. Be polite. Be courteous. And don't hog the conversation just like you wouldn't want to hog the couch.
Right, and it also make the host's job a little bit easier, too.
Yeah, like I want you to know that when you interview me, you have to do less homework, because I can take it and I can roll with it and I can answer those questions.
So we move on to part three in the book, Behind the Desk. What's the concept behind the desk?
Yeah, so see, the thing is, it's not about how you speak on stage that usually gets you booked back. It's about how you prepared before you got on stage. And sadly, most people that aren't professional speakers, the amount of time that they give before the presentation, in other words, behind the desk rehearsing, it's usually around midnight or 1 a.m. the night before their presentation while they're designing their slides. And that's the absolute worst thing that you could do. Behind the desk is all about making sure that you've done the prep work necessary so that when that presentation comes up, you're not nervous, you're not scared, but you know you can flow and have fun with it. And unfortunately, because of our busy lives, people use this as the excuse, and they don't prep enough. Preparation is the key. And the funny thing about this, I'm going to quote one of the best motivational speakers of all time, Zig Ziglar, because he was religious about memorizing his presentations, for the most part, word for word, and then he could spin off and improvise later. And when people would tell him that they don't want to give a memorized presentation because it sounds canned, his response was, do you want this in normal dialogue, or would you like me to do the Zig Ziglar accent?
Right.
Okay, here's the Zig Ziglar accent. He says this. He goes, if your presentation sounds canned, then you haven't canned your presentation. That's my best Zig Ziglar impersonation. It's horrible, I know. But makes a lot of sense, right? You got to can that thing so well that it just flows naturally.
How important is it to always get paid?
That's actually one of the tips that Brian Tracy gave a friend of mine years and years ago. He goes, always get paid. And this is probably the difference between what I call a professional versus a public speaker, by the way.
Okay.
A professional speaker always gets paid, but a public speaker has to pay. So the difference there is the public speaker pays for their own gas, their own airfare, their own hotel, their own food, and they walk away with less money in the bank account. But I encourage people not to be public speakers, but to be professional speakers, meaning that when they get off stage, hopefully they have more money in their bank account than they had before, either by being paid to speak or being able to sell something while they speak or being able to collect leads so that could further turn into sales when they speak, or they motivate their employees to where they're more productive so their efficiency goes up and they have higher profit margins. There should always be some aspect when you're speaking, if you're doing it professionally at least, that you're actually, it's worth your time. The investment is well spent and you make more money as a result of it.
Chapter 16, you have some helpful hints. Even point out critical errors. A, stop thinking that you are Kevin Costner. Start.
If you build it, they will come.
Yeah, start thinking that you are the Karate Kid and find a mentor. Very interesting. Yeah. And I like the idea of finding a mentor.
Well, if you look at anybody who's been successful in any area of life, the one thing that you're going to discover is that they didn't do it on their own. They have somebody who is smarter, faster, healthier, fitter, whatever it is, that could kind of guide them into that direction. Speaking is no different. I think you should have mentors that are available to you that you can reach out to. You did a lovely quote from Steve Siebold. He's my mentor. If I got questions, I know I can give him a call and say, God, am I saying this the right way? Am I pissing off the audience when I phrase it this way? Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? And he's there for me to guide me. I've got a couple. I've got people that I think are far more skilled at it than I am, like your Steve Siebold. But then I also have people that maybe aren't as skilled as I am in the profession, but yet I value their opinion, and I want them to share with me how what I say is coming across in the right way. So you've got to find people that can that you respect, that you'll listen to, that when they give you feedback, you go, that's pretty valid.
How important is it to find a promoter, someone to help you to, you know, be able to get around and be able to get your message out there?
Well, probably depends upon how far you want to take the realm of professional speaker. Mm-hmm. If you're a CEO of a company and you just want to get out and speak, you probably don't need to find a specific promoter, but you should have somebody who is your advocate. Because very rarely is the speaker the right person to negotiate the terms of the presentation. It's just weird. It devalues the information that the person is going to be having. And for the most part, generally speaking, and I'm totally guilty of this one, Kevin, we're usually the worst salespeople for ourselves. So if I go into a negotiation for a company that wants me to speak, say, at a keynote speech at their conference, I will almost invariably drop my prices, discount things, give away so much more than I should, to where it's frankly not even worth my time, energy, or effort. But if I've got somebody like my Jody McLean, who's in my office here, she's my director of business development. I send all the presentation requests to her. She's like a bulldog, man. She defends my value, and she sits there and negotiates far better rates than I ever would be able to.
Again, we are speaking with Topher Morrison, talking with him about his great new book, The Book on Public Speaking, and he's here with us just for a few more moments. Probably one other thing I wanted to kind of point out in Chapter 22, having some bumps. Folks, how important is it for folks to realize that, yes, you may be a professional, but there could be some rough patches from time to time?
Yeah, well, you know, I always say you're not a professional speaker until you've forgotten what you're going to say, had a biological accident, fall asleep on stage, forget where you're at. Those things just kind of come with the territory. I remember I actually fell asleep one time on stage speaking, believe it or not. I was just exhausted. I'd done the presentation hundreds of times. I knew what I was going to say, and before I knew it, I was talking and my eyes were closed, but I don't remember what I was saying, and I opened up my eyes and I looked out to a shocked audience that God only knows what they heard me saying. Who knows? You're going to expect some bumps. The economy's going to go up. The economy's going to go down. You're going to get people in the audience who disagree with you, who fight you, who heckle you. That's all a part of the territory. If you expect to get up on stage and just have everybody hanging on to your every word, you're probably confused, especially in today's culture. You can almost measure your effectiveness as a speaker based upon how many faces are lit up with the screens of their phones in the audience. You can really tell how you're losing the audience based upon how many phones start clicking on and they start checking their voicemail or their messages or their email. So you're going to have the bumps. You're going to have it. It comes in any profession. The key is you got to be able to bounce back and appreciate those things, because if you don't want to have any problems,
get out of the business.
Is there anybody in our everyday life that we may see on TV or hear on the radio that sometimes you marvel and you go, wow, this individual is a really good public speaker? Or are there others who you're like going, I'm surprised that he's able to manage the English in a language?
Yeah, well, all you have to do is turn on CNN, Fox News, CNBC to find a whole litany of those individuals, you know, and the easier ones are probably the ones that just horrify you. You know, setting political opinion aside, Donald Trump is just amazing when he gets up and speaks and he says what he says. I mean, he probably violates everything you shouldn't do as a public speaker. It's crazy. But to be fair, I could equally criticize Nancy Pelosi as well, who's one of the worst speakers I've ever seen. I can't imagine how she's in charge of leadership for the Democratic Party as well. It boggles my mind. Some other ones on the right and the left, I think Ari Fleischer is one of the best speakers I've ever heard.
Agreed.
He was the, I think he was the White House press secretary for, was it Bush?
Yep.
I think it was Bush.
It was Bush.
Unbelievably articulate, beautifully, very powerful, spoke with articulation, spoke with power and with clarity. And then you compare him to to the first press secretary that Trump had. Well, I'm blanking on his name now. What was his name?
I think it was Sean.
Sean Spicer. Yeah, that poor guy got thrown into the lion's den and just got shredded up. Not very effective. So you can, you know, if you look at presidents, there's no question that Barack Obama was one of the most powerful orators out there,
sure,
along with Reagan. You know, Ronald Reagan was just beautiful in their ability to speak. So, and if you, by the way, if you, interestingly enough, if you look at the people who are great at speaking versus the ones who are terrible at speaking, what you'll also notice is there's probably direct correlation to how they transform the world positively as well, how they get people into their favor and on their side. And that's something that both Reagan and Obama did very well. I think Trump's having a real hard time right now. I think he's struggling because he's not articulate. He doesn't prepare things. When he goes off teleprompter, he derails and creates explosions. But when he reads the teleprompter, he seems so artificial and insincere that nobody believes him. And he's got to really work on that if he wants to bring this country together and stop the divisiveness.
Been speaking with Topher Morrison, talking about his new book, the book on public speaking. We just got a couple of moments left here. If folks want to be able to purchase this great book, how can they get this? Is it on bookshelves or is it online somewhere?
Yeah, it's in bookstores nationwide. It's also online. You can go to Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com. Pretty much just search for the book on public speaking with my name, Topher Morrison, and I'm sure you'll find 100 different places you can purchase it.
Do you have a website that if folks want to find out more about you?
Yeah, then go to TopherMorrison.com. That's T-O-P-H-E-R, TopherMorrison.com. They can check me out.
Topher, I want to thank you.
Hassle me, whatever they want to do.
You got it. I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule and teaching a guy like me a few things and sharing it with my audience.
Kevin, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for the honor to be on your show, and I hope that one day I get to be back and share some other ideas.
All right. That's Topher Morrison, again, our guest here on Monday Night Talk. And folks, that's all the time that we have this evening. We will step aside to South Shore Live up next. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great evening.